like it. Nothing like it. All right, but tonight we are continuing, and we are continuing from the head down. We've covered a lot of the head, and we've even made it to the neck. The next body part would be
shoulders.
We're not up to the arm. We're certainly not up to the heart. That's a long way down. No. So tonight is shoulders. Can anyone think of anything in the Torah, anywhere, that deals with, no cheating, that deals with shoulders? This one's not as obvious as some of the previous ones.
Shouldering the load.
Carrying the ark.
Carrying the ark is probably one of the primary sources. Yeah. Well done, David. Could.
Shouldering the responsibility.
Okay, the expression, shouldering responsibility, we'll get to that. But any other either stories or mitzvot that are associated with shoulders?
We carry things on your shoulders.
You do. We do carry things. Well, you want to think a minute? No. You just want the answers.
More hints.
Okay. Yeah. One hint is at the very, very, very end of the Torah. The end of the book of Devarim, the end of the book of Deuteronomy, where Moses is giving a blessing to each one of the tribes. One of the tribes, actually, where it describes his portion in the land of Israel, it describes something between his shoulders.
Yishikar.
No, but you're not that one, but you're right. We'll get to that. That's Jacob's blessing to Yisachar. But I'm talking at the very end. Benjamin. It talks about God dwelling bein ktefav, between his shoulders. What does that mean? God dwells between his shoulders.
His portion.
Yes.
The shoulder must be in the top and in the middle, you know. That's where the temple sits.
Oh, the temple.
Yes.
Oh, the temple. Yes. That's exactly what it is. It's not necessarily on the high point of the geography of the land, right. Meaning it's not in the north, right? It's really in the center. Less than center. It's really lower than center. But it's on a high point, topographically. Yes. It's in Job. But it's referring to the temple, which was known as between its shoulder, which we're going to talk about. And then the last thing is, what's the Hebrew word for shoulder? You don't know the Yiddish either. Okay, so hold on to that. We will see. Let's start with the basics. Let's start with David's example in terms of there's a mitzvah in the Torah. We know that when the Jews were wandering through the desert, right, one of the first things that they were commanded to do after the giving of the Torah, according to Rashi, at least chronologically how it happened, is that they were told, they were given the charge of building the tabernacle. But in Hebrew, we call the Mishkan, which was the portable sanctuary that wandered with them in their travels through the desert. Ultimately, even after they got into the land of Israel, that was the ark, one of the major, major vessels in the tabernacle. Right? Ultimately, that's the precursor to where a few hundred years later, what's built? No longer the tabernacle, but the temple, the Beit HaMikdash. Okay? The Holy Temple. The primary vessel that was in the tabernacle or the temple was the Aron Kodesh, the Ark. We refer to this as the Ark, right? The place which houses the Torah. It's known as the Ark or an Aron Kodesh. This was a portable one. Why? Because, as I said, they traveled. You have to take the vessels with you. It's not like you just rent a U-Haul, load it up, and move on. Although, almost all the vessels that were in the tabernacle were transported by wagon. Who were in charge? You're like, whoa, I didn't know that. Say it.
I didn't know.
See? It's good you came.
I did not know that.
They almost all the vessels. Who were in charge of taking care and carrying the vessels? Which? Who? The Levites. Excellent. The Levites were in charge. The Levites are broken up into three branches. Levi, who Levites all come from, hence the name, Levi, right? Levite, had three sons, Gershon, Kahat, and Merari. It's not on the final, don't worry. Okay? Gershon, Kahat, and Merari. Each one of them had a certain job regarding carrying the vessels and taking care of the curtains and the poles and the planks and the this and that, all the different materials, as well as many of the vessels. All of them. Anyone that was in the Gershon clan or that was in the Merari clan and their jobs, they were allowed to be transported via wagon. Only Kahat, their grouping, specifically the ark being the primary vessel that they were in charge of, the Torah goes out of the way to say, Bakotef Yisa'u, on their shoulders shall it be carried. It was not allowed to be done with a wagon. It had to be carried by human beings on their shoulders. Now, how did you carry it on your shoulders? Most of us, when you carry something, it's in your hands. So what do you mean on their shoulders?
Because there was a staff.
Ah, there were poles. Max wants to use the fancy word. Staves that were put in, right? The poles that had to... Now here, interestingly enough, we have to talk about this as well. There is an absolute prohibition. It is 100% forbidden to take those poles out of the side of the ark. Okay, interesting piece of information. I'll just put it in perspective. This is as much a prohibition as it is if you tell somebody you're not allowed to eat pork. You know, everybody like, oh my God, that's like, you know, that's... Sorry, chazer treif. Right, hence the word. Okay, that's like... Taking the poles out of the ark was like that. Stealing, they're all on the same level. Those are big no-nos. But here's the problem. We're told a fascinating piece of information that when this group were carrying the ark, miraculously, they didn't carry the ark. The ark carried them. Now, I don't know if that literally means that the ark levitated off the ground and everybody's holding on for dear life like one of those, you know, rides at the amusement park, you know, that you're taking. I don't know if that's exactly what it means, but what it clearly means is that they weren't really carrying it. The ark carried itself, didn't need their help. Now, what's the significance of this? And that begs the bigger question. If in fact the ark carried itself, then what's the big deal about the poles? The whole point of the poles is to carry it, right? Carry it. Sorry, my Brooklyn accent gets in there sometimes. Okay? So if it carried itself, then who needs the poles? So to such an extent that there's a prohibition to ever remove them. Seems a little problematic, does it not, Randy?
Well, the poles... They probably say not to remove them, so it makes them a permanent part of the ark.
Correct, but why?
You're not using an aid to carry them.
But I don't need to. If basically it carries itself, who needs the poles? You want to tell me for all the other vessels, I understand, because how are you going to carry it?
Right.
You need some mechanism by which you can carry it. But if the ark carried itself... then who needs the poles? And if you think that this is just some interesting tidbit of information, if you go down a little bit in history, you'll find the story with King David. King David, actually, when he won the war against the Philistines, one of many, right? And he got the ark back, and he was transporting it to bring it back into Jewish camp, so to say. He went ahead, and the Tanakh tells us, that he went ahead and he put it on a new wagon and he started transporting it. And there was a fellow by the name of Uzziah who was right nearby, who the wagon was you know, shaking a little bit, and Uzziah was concerned for the welfare of the ark. So he reached out and touched and grabbed the ark, the Aron. You ever see Raiders of the Lost Ark? Yeah. when he opens up the ark and he melts. Yeah, this is close, right? He dies. He dies. And everybody's up in arms. He was doing this for the honor of the ark, the honor of God. Why can it? What did we do wrong? Until David realized he forgot a basic law in the Torah. It's not allowed to be transferred on a wagon. This is to be transported by human being on their shoulders. One of the questions we'll deal with towards the end is how could David forget such a basic law? Every, you know, ask any kid who's ever studied Torah, that's a basic principle. How does he not know this? But let's leave that for now. Okay? The question, let's go back to the question. If these poles were really, for all intents and purposes, ornamental handles, because they didn't serve the function of carrying, because as I said, the ark carried itself, then why do we need them? Listen to a beautiful, beautiful answer. It'll get us back into understanding what this role of carrying on your shoulders means. If I told you that I have a job for you, now unbeknownst to you, the job is basically a simple job. It's going to happen whether you really work hard at it or not, but I don't tell you that. And you go ahead and you do it. And I, wanting to give you full credit, I give you full credit for all of the effort you put forth. I know the truth that it was no big deal. I did most of the work ahead of time, right? I just need you to flip the switch and, hey, great job there. God is doing us a tremendous favor. The ark doesn't need our help. The Torah, which is housed in the ark, right? The ark being symbolic of the Torah, doesn't need our help. The Torah can stand just fine on its own. Let's call a spade a spade. Sure, it needs people to fulfill it. And I use the word need in quotes because God doesn't need us to fulfill it either. The Torah doesn't need any help. But to give credit to the ones who bear it, to the ones who carry it, God says, great job. I'll give you credit. You worked at it. You put in effort to make it happen. I didn't need you. But you did it. If you go ahead and you work at something, and again, the condition being that you're sincere, you're devoted, and you give it your all, then even if it could have stood on its own, you get the credit. You get the credit for doing it. On that condition of you're ready to bear the full brunt, the full effort of heavy carrying the heavy Torah responsibility. If you do your part, you get credit. No, the poles are not really necessary. But if you're going to carry the Torah, and I'm not just talking because you physically went ahead and put it on your shoulders. I'm talking about bearing down and taking the responsibility. Like, what was the expression you used before? Shouldering responsibility. It's funny that that's the expression. Because that's what it means to carry someone. You put it on your shoulder. I got it. I'll take care of it. I'll be responsible. If that's your approach to Torah, you are willing and ready and able at all times. The poles never come out. That means I'm ready at all times to carry it with the devotion, the commitment to what the Torah stands for.
That kind of commitment, the Torah is really carrying you.
That's the beauty of it. But it will only carry you if that's really your commitment. The two have to work hand in hand. Mm-hmm. They have to. And that's really the message. The Torah doesn't need you to carry it. Right. But if you're going to carry it, you say, I'm committed. I'm going to really do my best to do it. Mm-hmm. Then you know what? The end result is you get credit. And not only that, the Torah is going to carry you down the road. Did you ever hear the expression, more than the Jew has kept Shabbos, Shabbos has kept the Jew? Mm-hmm. It's so true. It's so true. Throughout the millennia, that's been our saving grace. I mean, let's be honest. The year is 2019. The Jewish people are still here. Any bookie from the last 5,000 years who bet against us lost. They've all lost. There's not a bookie who's made money on the Jewish people yet. Because we defy every odd. It makes no sense. I think it's because of this. We have all committed to say, I'm going to carry that ark. I will carry the ark. And when you carry it, at the end, it carries you. That's the beautiful message about this. You give credit to those who are dedicated, ready to carry it on their shoulders. In today's day and age, that's what it is. It doesn't make sense. We're in, you know, when the Jews were coming to this country, not even 100 years ago, after the war, 75 years ago, they said Torah would never survive here. Look it up in history. Our ancestors, it's not that long ago. Certainly our grandparents, our great-grandparents for sure, right? They called it the Golden of Medina, right? This was the golden land. Why? Because they thought everything, it was paved in gold. The prosperity was great and wonderful. And the minute they got on the boat on the way to come here, what's the first thing that went overboard? Tefillin. They threw out their tefillin because I'm not going to let that stop me from... They said it'll never work here. Torah will never survive. Never. You never heard that? It was a common refrain. The thought of opening a yeshiva on American soil? Unheard of. Rev. Aaron Cutler, the one who opened up the little tiny yeshiva in Lakewood, New Jersey, that is now the largest in America, right? Was his vision.
That's why my parents never taught us. We knew nothing about Judaism, the first generation.
Yeah. They said it would never happen. It would never survive.
Many of the rabbis in pre-war Europe called it the Treifa Medina.
The Treifa Medina, right? This was Treif. This was as unclean and defiled as one can possibly get. There's no way. And here we are. Thank God. Thank God. Less than 100 years later, thousands and thousands and thousands of people living beautiful Jewish lives. Why? How? Because there were many, many people who said, I will carry the ark. I will make sure that I will shoulder that responsibility. I cannot afford to let it go. That's what they did. We are the beneficiaries of that. They carried it. It would explain even the terminology. Remember, the verse stated that this group of Levites from Kahat, right? That group, they are to carry this ark on their shoulders. How do you say the word on in Hebrew? Oh, come on, folks. This is an easy one. I'm throwing you a meatball over the plate. Come on.
On.
Yeah, on in Hebrew. Like, for example, you make the bracha when you sit down to eat your matzah at the Seder. Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam, Asher Kidesh Shem V'Zayis V'Zivanu, blank, achilat matzah. Al, thank you. Al achilat matzah, on the mitzvah of eating. Al means on. See? Right? Al mikra megillah. Right? On the reading of the Megillah. There's 100 of these. They're all al this, al that. Al mitzvah tefillin every morning. It's al. On this mitzvah. Right? So I would have expected this verse that says that they're to carry it on their shoulders. It should be al on tevav, their shoulders. Doesn't say it. It says ba katef yisau. Literally, when you have a bet in front of a word, it means, sometimes it means on, but more commonly, it means
in.
Like, for example, in the Shema, we say these words should be, right? We say, al levavecha, on your heart. But then a little bit later on, we say, bil vavcha, or bil vavi mishkan evne, right? For those who know those, right? The bet in front means in. So why would it say baka tef yiso? In their shoulders they should carry it? Yeah. Because it's not just, we're not talking about physical on your shoulder. We're talking about internalizing this message into your bones. Into the shoulder. Carry it. This is your message. This has to become your essence. because it all hinges on this. It's really, really important. The message of the Aaron needs to be internalized as part of the essence of the person. Maybe this would explain why King David made his mistake and put it on a wagon, something that even the young kids knew not to do. It's because you have to know a little bit about King David. While tremendous in many, many, many regards, and I know we touched on it when we talked a little bit about his work of Tehillim on Psalms, but was he perfect? By no stretch. By no stretch of the imagination, made mistakes. One of the things that our sages point out, while he did an amazing job of teaching the Jewish people and putting together these collection of psalms which are put to music, he actually referred to the Torah as music. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Good.
You would think... good. And wow, Mrs. Z is like cut you off at the knees and says, that's sacrilegious. So here we have an emotional response. It seems very good, right? And then you have a very, very, you know, sacrilegious. You got to play by the rules here. So you're a Talmudic scholar, must be, because the Talmud actually states that. The Talmud says that because King David took away a little bit of the reverence and said, yeah, it's like music. You know, it's... that's cool to listen to. You know, we can set Torah to music. Not taking anything away from music. But Torah is not music. Torah has musical concepts. Torah can be put to music. But don't equate Torah and music. They're not. Torah is at least one step above that. Because he referred to it as music, he lacked a certain reverence for it, and therefore he made such a common mistake. Yeah, if you can treat it like that, then yeah, we can put it on a wagon. That's okay. No, 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 no. We're talking about the Torah here. The Torah has to be on your shoulders. A burden that needs to be borne. You have to carry it with tremendous reverence and understanding and that concept. Now, let's take it another step. Somebody mentioned, I believe Monroe mentioned it.
Oh, would you back up a step? Please, yes.
Yes.
Could we amplify that, unpack it, what you just said about the Torah has music, but it is not music.
That's correct.
So that's what we're saying.
I'm totally on board with that.
So
yes,
there's music in Torah.
100%. You have songs in the Torah.
Right. Right.
So. Song of the Sea. You have Devorah's song. You have many, many songs in the Torah. Of course there's music in Torah. There's a lot of parallels, by the way. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to let you get me off here. But music has tremendous... I think I've quoted this before. They say over from the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon lived in the 1800s, 1700s, late 1700s. Who just... whatever. He doesn't need my approbation. I'll never, ever be the dirt under his fingernails. I mean, they were talking about somebody who brought so much Torah knowledge to the world. They say in his name, I obviously never heard it, but they say in his name that if not for the wisdom of Torah, the wisdom of classical music would be the highest level of wisdom in the world.
Say that again.
If not for the wisdom of Torah... that which would rank as number one would be classical music. The level of wisdom that's associated with it and how you're able to, I don't know music well enough, but to be able to harness that power and put it into music is a tremendous amount of wisdom. The fact that there's seven notes on a scale, am I correct? No? Maybe not. I thought they were. Do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti. Back to do. So we'll call it eight?
There are other scales.
Nah, that's the only scale. No, no, no. Every other scale in my house is broken. Especially the one that tells me how much I weigh. In theory, though, but there's a lot of parallels. I don't want to get into it too much, but in Kabbalistic literature, it talks a lot about this concept of music and how it parallels many, many things in Torah. Okay. But Monroe did mention that at the very end of Bereshit, at the end of the book of Genesis, where Yaakov Avinu, our patriarch Jacob, is on his deathbed and he calls together all of his children and he gives them each a blessing. Some are more obvious blessings than other. But here's what he calls his son Yisachar. Issachar. He says the following. Yisachar chamor garem. Yisachar is a strong-boned donkey. He rests between the boundaries. He saw tranquility that it was good in the land that it was pleasant. Yet he bent his shoulder to bear and he became an indentured laborer. What does any of that mean? Very poetic, it's deep mystical stuff, but what, in plain simple terms, he's comparing Yisachar to a donkey.
Yeah.
Most of us would take offense to that, especially if it started with the word Jack, right?
Jack Donkey.
Jack Donkey, exactly. Okay? What can you tell me about a donkey?
It has four legs.
It has four legs, that is true. Something unique about it, perhaps.
Does not reproduce.
That's a mule. Donkeys do reproduce.
It must be redeemed.
Give me plain stuff. Stop giving me all this stubborn. Judaism
loyal.
Stuff.
Stubborn.
It's what?
They're loyal.
Stubborn.
They're dumb.
They're dumb. I said unique.
They play softball.
They're strong.
They're strong, thank you. Typically, when you hire and you get a donkey, it does what for you? It's a beast of burden, thank you. It is a schlepper. It is a serious, serious schlepper, loaded up. The Torah tells us, in fact, that when the Jews left Egypt, they left very wealthy. Remember, we looted Egypt. Who carried all that stuff? Wasn't you, it wasn't me. The donkeys did. That's correct. The Torah says the donkeys got loaded up. In fact, because of what you said, Monroe, we're going to take a tiny little tangent. And that is, the donkey is only one of two non-kosher animals that are used in the performance of a mitzvah. To do a mitzvah, you need to use kosher stuff. You cannot make the leather for your tefillin, right, out of a non-kosher animal. No can do. It may be cheap, it may be accessible, but no can do. You must use a kosher animal. For food, obviously, that's kosher food. For performance of any mitzvah, there's only two exceptions. The donkey is used in the performance of a mitzvah, which is what? What is the donkey used for in the mitzvah? But what mitzvah, specific mitzvah in the Torah that you have to do with a donkey?
Oh, it was the firstborn.
The firstborn male donkey has to be redeemed, similar to a firstborn male son. I'm not equating for those who are keeping score. Right? Not every firstborn male son is a donkey. Okay, but there is a comparison in terms of the mitzvah to redeem it. Because the firstborn male donkey truly belongs to God. Really? My firstborn horse is mine. God wants nothing to do with it. He says, it's yours. The only non-kosher animal that needs to be redeemed, its firstborn, is a donkey. And they say, Monroe, that the reason is it because it's payback as a reward for helping us when we left Egypt. Because we were beneficiaries of it carrying all of our loot as we left, we will use it in the performance of a mitzvah, which is an upgrade. That's one non-kosher animal. What's the other?
Snail.
No.
Camel.
A what?
Camel.
A camel? No.
A dog.
That's correct. A dog. Dog is a non-kosher animal. And Randy's like, what mitzvah is used with a dog? I'm a mind reader. You were thinking that. What mitzvah is used with a dog? Either you're all very, very humble and you don't want to sound so smart.
Well, because they didn't bark in Egypt.
Yeah. That is true. That's why we use it. But what mitzvah is it associated with?
That's for rewarding the dog, not.
Yeah, so okay. You can say it.
I'm trying to remember.
You basically said it.
Okay. So if there's something that if you can't do something, then you give it to the dog. And I don't remember the specifics.
Okay. The specific is that we know that to make an animal kosher, to be eaten, it has to be slaughtered properly. You can't shoot it. You can't kill it in other manner. It has to be done through a ritual process known as shechita, slaughtering. Okay. If you find that animal, which you slaughtered properly, but you do an internal examination on some of its major organs, which you have to do to check to see if there's a hole in the lung or it has some heart defect, and certain list of defects that you have to check for. And if it does have it, even though it's a kosher species, you're not allowed to eat it. Says the Torah, what should you do with it?
Give it to the dog.
Give it to the dog. Specifically, it identifies the dog. La kelev tashlichunoto. Give it to the dog as a reward for it not barking and making our lives miserable as we left Egypt. Those are the only two non-kosher animals used in some performance of the mitzvah. Okay? But the donkey is known as a beast of burden. It's there because it has strong bones to carry. Says Jacob, Yisachar, my son. Yisachar, my son. You are like a strong-boned donkey. What, pray tell, is Yisachar carrying that he would be compared to the donkey? What's he bearing on his shoulders that's so important that he would be... What?
He wouldn't be a Levite, right?
Nope.
Torah.
Say it again.
Torah.
Explain.
I didn't get that far.
When we did last year, we talked about the tribes, right? We talked about a unique partnership that existed amongst two brothers, Yisachar and Zevulun. They had a deal. They made a very, very smart deal with each other. Yisachar, he's the one who's going to dedicate himself as the academic. He's going to study Torah. That's what his full-time profession will be. He's going to make sure that he knows it. He's going to make sure that he teaches it. He's going to make sure that it's done properly and the judges will come and all of the things will come from Yisachar. But let's ask the question. Who's paying to keep this guy going?
His brother.
His brother Zevulun. Zebulun made a deal with him. He said, listen, I'm the sea merchant. I'm happy to go out into business. But I also need to learn Torah. But I can't do both, and you can't do. You know what? Let's make a partnership. I'll support your studying Torah, Zevulun says. I'll support you, Yisachar, on condition that the merits you accrue in terms of studying Torah, I get 50% too. I'll give you 50% business, you give me 50% spiritual reward. Deal, and they both shook, and they had a deal. It's called the Yisachar-Zevulun partnership. To this day, it exists, by the way.
He taught his brother half of what he knew.
He didn't teach half of it. He said, I'll teach you whatever I know, but the reward in the next world and all of that, what a Torah life provides, he was willing to share 50-50. We were complete partners, he said.
Do you think that's a complete deal? Because we do get reward from Torah in this world also.
We do? We do?
I think so.
Really? Where do I cash that check? You mean there's intangible benefits?
I think they're tangible.
In what sense? Leading a kind of life?
Right, you get certain like joy and like
reward. Those are intangibles, exactly. I'm not saying there's no reward, that a person's life isn't better because of it, but is we believe that the reward for doing any mitzvah is not in this world. It's the way I'll describe it is if you have stock in a company that gives dividends, right? The principal, the stock's value is not what you're getting dividends on. Right? You get a dividend check. That's benefits in this world. You can get a dividend check by living a Torah life. But the principle of what you own for owning the stock, that's the next world. These are dividend checks that you're able to... Some we are able to cash more dividend checks than others. But that's not the principle. Hunter.
All right. My question has to do with like this partnership. How is it that All right, so Torah is supposed to be something that like every individual is participant in, and you get reward for that in the next life for doing it. Why would God like respect this agreement? It's kind of like letting somebody, you know, not have to study Torah, just letting somebody who already likes Torah to study it more.
I thought you were going to ask it a little differently, which I thought you were going to say to me, that doesn't seem fair in the sense of, I didn't learn it. How can I get rewarded? Good, I made a deal with you.
Well, I mean, in that sense, it's the same factor of like, oh, I'm going to learn more Torah, you're not going to learn Torah. But they're splitting it 50-50. So if if each of them believes, all right, I get 50% benefit, whatever, it matches up. I'm wondering why or does God respect that deal?
Great. I'll go even further. If you were to list the two brothers in an order, who would you put first in preferential treatment? Who would you put ahead?
According to...
In this concept, let's say you have to list them one at a time.
It would probably be Issachar.
You put Issachar first, the one who represents Torah, right? Mm-hmm. Guess what? It is. Zvulun comes first many, many times. Mm-hmm. And the sages ask, hey, granted they have a partnership, but doesn't Torah go first? The response is as follows. And for those, and this is really important, not everyone is meant to study Torah all day. Mm-hmm. It's not for everyone. Please mark my words carefully. I am not saying that every single person can't learn Torah, because that's not true. Every single person can learn Torah to whatever extent they can. The responsibility of the person who chooses to be a doctor, lawyer, businessman, whatever profession they choose outside of teacher, okay? That profession, is it held against them that they're not going to have as much time to study Torah?
No.
Why not? Why not? Who told you to choose that profession? Every single person should be a Torah scholar.
I mean, if in this concept, if they're giving the money to...
No. You don't like that concept. You can't fall back on it.
Well, it's not so much that I don't really like it. I'm wondering why do we believe...
So I'm asking you, let's play it out.
Okay.
If that is correct, let's say you're right, that why should that be a good partnership? The guy has the same responsibility, Zvulun has the same responsibility to study Torah as does Yisachar. How can he absolve that responsibility by paying it off? Right? That's your question. I'm throwing another question back at you, as Jews do, right? And that is, what right do you have to become a doctor? What right do you have to become a lawyer? You should be a Torah teacher, period. End of conversation. Everybody needs to be poor Jews teaching Torah.
Well, I mean, that's just not going to work.
Why not?
You need somebody.
No. So you're telling me, okay, just practically. My answer is no. I'll tell you why. Mm-hmm. How many brothers how many tribes are there?
12.
Why?
Because each has their
individual. That's correct. Each one has a unique function. They are not meant to be 12 identical brothers. We are not meant to be exactly the same. There are those who are more inclined for a Torah study, and there are those that are more inclined for business, and there are those that are more inclined for whatever profession it is. They each have a place in the Torah world. The doctor who devotes an hour of his day, whether it's early, early in the morning or late, late, late at night when he's done his 12-hour rotation and he's zonked out of his mind and he still devotes an hour a day, is maybe, I don't work for God's accounting team, but I could see God saying that hour of Torah study is as beloved to me as the fellow who sat in the Beit Midrash for 6 hours, 8 hours, 10 hours. That is just as beloved because that's the amount he can give me.
Okay, but then why?
So Yisachar needs Zvulun. How is Yisachar going to do it? If everyone's going to be a Torah scholar, who's going to pay for all this?
But then why isn't it not just that Zvulun, he runs his business, but an hour a day he studies Torah?
He does. My answer is he does.
Okay.
He does. And that's exactly true. There's not one person who isn't obligated to devote whatever time they can to Torah study. Zvulun's not off the hook, but when he's finished with his business, he can go play Nintendo Switch. Mm-hmm. or watch Netflix. That's not Zavula. No, 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 no. He can't just be, well, I wrote the check to the Kollel, I'm good to go for another year. It doesn't work that way.
But then my question is, why does he get credit for writing that check? Why isn't it not just like charity or something? Like, why is he genuinely getting that benefit?
The answer, I think the answer is pretty obvious. Well, who's facilitating Yisachar learning?
Zavula.
That's why. That's why.
So it's counted as just as
100%. And that is, if you're taking notes, this is how executive directors get people to pay. Because she's busting her can, making sure that everything here is done right, right? Who's paying for all this? Yeah, it's called a partnership. You help pay for all of this, you get a part of it. That's how it works. And it has to work that way. I'll get to you in one second. It has to work that way. It's not meant for everybody to be Torah scholars. Everyone is obligated to put forth whatever effort they can. Don't, and you have to be honest with yourself. Don't say, well, I do put in an hour if you have 2 hours. That's still obligated. Zavulun has an obligation to study Torah. But not as much as Yisachar. Because Yisachar spends his day doing it. Zvulun finds the other time because he's spending his day in business. That's the partnership. But the point that I'm making, and I'll get to your questions, right, is that Yisachar is able to bear that burden with the help of Zvulun.
So in that case, God honors the agreement.
That's correct. Okay. That's right. Because Zvulun is facilitating that. Mm-hmm. I can't do it without you.
The additional benefit is he's able to, because he's sustaining his brother is able not only to study, but to teach his
correct.
Other people.
Correct. That's correct. That's correct. That's why it's such a good partnership. But you're right. Your point is well taken. Zvulun's not absolved from Torah study. To whatever extent he can, that's what he has to do.
So now it sounds like really Zvulun should have more credit because he's also doing his part of the deal, which you're saying is equal in God's eyes in the first place to someone else studying all day.
That's why he goes first.
And he's getting credit.
That's right. That's why he's listed first. That's right. That's why Zvulun is first.
You had a question. Two comments. One is half a question. One is that...
As long as I don't give a half an answer.
and then together it'll be a partnership and
more.
So the first comment is, so you talked about in the book, right, to carry the responsibility of Torah internally,
right?
And I guess part of what I heard when you said that, and this may be my own reading into it, is that part of that is responsibility to the other and the community, right? And Kollel Yisrael, right? And to that end, that partnership is emblematic of exactly that.
I didn't say it, but it's certainly true. The whole point of learning, I shouldn't say it that way. There's a point in learning just by itself. But part of the expectation of anything we learn in Torah is to be shared. That is an expectation. Right? Someone said, one second, how's it go? Right. The Rashi says, where is it? One second. Parshat Bechukotai, that's where it is. Yeah. If you follow my decrees and observe my commandments and perform them, Rashi's bothered by that terminology. Right? The verse contains three phrases that seem to be repetitious. Their combined meaning is as follows. If you will follow my decrees by engaging in intensive Torah study with the intention that such study will lead you to observe my commandments properly, and if you actually do perform them, you'll merit the blessing given in the following verses. Rashi says right there on this phrase, if you will go in my... Rashi says, Shetihi amelim batorah. Amelim means to be toiling. Put in effort, toil. Le'amel means to toil. Somebody said to me once, Le'amel is also an acronym, which stands for Lilmod al Menat Lelamed. Learn on condition to teach. You know what toiling in Torah means? I'm going to learn it well enough that I can give it over. I remember vividly sitting down, my father, Zichron Levracha, would say, Tzvi, let's go over what you learned in yeshiva today. And of course, I had a million reasons not to. Most primarily is I probably didn't know it. And he would say, all right, let's go over the Talmud. Let's read that piece of Gemara. And, you know, I'd read it. And he'd say, what does this mean? I got it. I know, Dad. He says, well, if you know it, then tell me. He says, well, I know it, but I can't tell it over. That was like the kiss of death. Don't ever say that to my father. Because that meant, if you can't tell it over to me, you just don't know it. No, I do, Dad, really, I do. So tell me. Amel, to toil, lilmod al menat lilamed. Learn in order to teach. Quickly, yes.
There's a teaching, I think it's in Talmud, I'm trying to remember, that says that you should, one of the things that specifically garners reward in the Rambha is setting aside a time, a specified time each week to learn.
Something like that.
Okay.
There is a concept of kavata itim la Torah, of setting aside time for Torah study. I don't think it says a week per week, but it does say that you're, because that's one of the questions that were asked after we passed from this world. Did you set aside time for learning? That's one of the questions we're asked. Okay. All right. So now I understand better why there's a comparison, right? Very nice comparison to Yisachar. He's that donkey who bears the brunt, who bears that responsibility specifically of Torah. But now let's move further here. I mentioned that the tribe of Benjamin, at the end of the Torah, Moses says that it's called the temple, but it says it as follows. Of Benjamin he said, may Hashem's beloved dwell securely by him. He hovers over him all day long and rests between his shoulders. Such a weird expression. That God's presence will dwell, right? It's the dwest I've ever been. Will dwell between his shoulders. So quickly, just cutting to the chase, it's talking about the area in Jerusalem where the Temple Mount stood. We know that the temple was almost exclusively in the tribe of Benjamin's territory. It was a tiny sliver that would belong to whom?
Judah.
It's good. It's worth reviewing every now and then, right? But Benjamin, God's presence rested between his shoulders. So, first of all, I think it's fascinating that if you know, how long did the second temple stand? How many years? How long did it stand?
It still exists.
No, it was destroyed. It was destroyed in the year 70 AD. 70 CE.
460.
No.
Which one? The second temple?
Second temple stood how long?
That's when Babylonian kicked the earth. Jews out to Babylonia.
That's the first temple.
460 plus 70.
Higher! I feel like the price is right. Higher! Lower! Higher! 420 years. Temple 1 is 410, Temple 2 is 420. Remember that. What year was the Exodus? What Hebrew year?
24. We're pointing at him, so I didn't want to say.
Go for it.
48.
2448. Good. Don't forget that. You got to know that. Roz, what is it?
2448.
That's it. That's what you got to know. Forevermore. No excuses, Randy.
Okay.
He's not coming back. Put him on the hot seat all night tonight.
Does that mean the third temple is going to stay in?
No, the first temple is forever. No. But what's fascinating is that the number 420... in Gematria, when you use numerical values, it's two letters, Tav and Chaf. Tav is 400, Chaf is 20. Nice and simple. Except if you spell it out, Tav, which is a Tav, Aleph, Vav, spells the word Tav, right? That's the letter. And Chaf is Chaf, Fe, right? Kaf. They're the same letters as Ktefav, which means his shoulders. Ooh, the 420 years that the temple stood, if you spell it out, it actually spells the word shoulders. Ooh. Okay, but let's see if we can spend a couple minutes to really understand this. Because I'm going to share with you a very important piece of information. And that is, there's another name for shoulders in the Torah. And I haven't shared it with you yet. I will be just in the spirit of full disclosure. I'd like to say that I'm using the word that I'm going to teach you with a little bit of loose translation. I'm using it as shoulder, but I do believe that the correct is that it's the trapezius muscle, which is the muscle that comes down from your neck and spreads till your actual shoulders. I'm using it as this whole area. I'm calling it shoulders because that's what the Torah does. But in fact, I think there's a difference between the word katef, which is we use a shoulder, and this new word called, anybody? I'll give you a hint. We know that Eliezer, the servant of Avraham, went out to go find a wife for Yitzchak. And he finds whom? What's her name?
Rebecca.
And what's the classic story? He makes up this thing that if I get to the well and this young maiden is going to offer me and my camels what to drink, then I know she's the right one because it's all about kindness, yada, yada, yada. Yes? And the Torah tells us that comes along Rivka and she's carrying the pitcher
on her shoulders.
But it doesn't use the word ktefav. It uses the word shchem. Shchem. Vikada al shechma. And her pitcher was on her shoulder. You find the same term when Avraham sends Hagar and Yishmael out of the house with water before they went out into the desert. There too it says she carried it al shechma, on her shoulder. Right? It's just interesting that the classic picture, I remember growing up with National Geographic, of in some of the, you know, countries, certainly in Africa, whatever it is, and they show women carrying pitchers. They're not carrying it on their shoulder, by the way.
Damn.
It's either on their head, right? Or right here in the back. It's really the back of the neck. And I always was fascinated. That's what we're talking about. That area, the trapezius muscle. I practice that word all day. Okay, it's Shechem. But you made a funny face, Juliana, when I said the word Shechem. Did something cross your mind? Shechem. What crossed your mind? Does it ring a bell of any sort?
It's a name.
Name of what?
God.
Name of God?
Yeah.
What?
It's the city.
You were doing so well to this point. It's the name of what?
It's the city where Dina was deported.
Oh, it's a city in Israel called Shechem. One of the incidents is where Dina was abducted and then raped. It's also the city in which Yosef is sold by his brothers. It's also the city later in history where King David's dynasty is split between Yehuda and Yisrael. There's a lot of things that happen here. But it's the name in English. It's known as, what's the name of Shechem in English?
Shechem.
No. In English.
You mean the town?
Anglis.
The town that's there now?
Yeah.
Nablus?
That's what it's called. It's called Nablus.
Really?
Yes. That's what it is. It's Nablus. All right, fine. You can stay. Survivor, you know. Okay, so very quickly. This word Shechem, besides being the name of a city, which we'll talk about in a minute, I want you to understand something. Torah is understood on so many levels. If you walk away with nothing else from my class over the years, walk away understanding that whatever we understand is not even scratching the surface of what's there. There's so many levels, an infinite number of levels. And what we try to do is to peel back one layer at a time to the best of our ability and understanding. But there are levels and levels. And the truth is, I have made a conscious decision that in talking about the shoulders, I would not go down deep enough to get into the Kabbalistic because it goes crazy about the shoulders acting as the conduit from all of the brain, your brain stem, right, back here, then goes down the sides, your arms, all of it goes off. Different parts of Adam, original Adam and Eve, and Cain and Abel, right hand, left hand, shoulders. It's all over the place. But we're not going there. But understand, though, that we could take it at least one or two steps deeper. This word Shechem, what does it mean? What does the word itself mean? So there's a debate amongst the authorities. Some say it just means a portion. Some say it means the city itself called Shechem. Because Jacob actually says to his son Joseph that I'm giving you Shechem Achad, one portion, more than your brothers. It happens to be that the city in which he gives him is Shechem. In what city is Joseph buried? In Shechem. Which unfortunately has been in the news over the last 10, 15 years, that every few years the Arabs riot and they desecrate Joseph's tomb in Nablus, in Shechem. And sure enough, you know, within 6 months, there's a group of Jews that get government permission to go there for a couple of days and fix the place up. But Yosef's buried in Shechem. And as Marcia correctly pointed out, this is a lot of things of tragic nature take place in Shechem. So, I read a piece from a fellow by the name of Rabbi Yochanan Bechhafer. I actually went to yeshiva with him, a little older than I am. Brilliant, brilliant scholar. So I came across something where he actually talks about this. And he says the following. He says that the word Shechem can actually be also understood, again, on a deeper level, as an acronym for Shem Kivod Malchuto. You know, this sounds somewhat familiar. We say, right, after you say Shema, Shema Yisrael Hashem HaGashem Echad, and in an undertone we say Baruch. Shem kivod malchuto li'olam va'ed. Shem kivod malchuto, the first letter spell out Shechem. What's the significance? So what? He says the following. The very first occurrence of the word Shechem in the Torah is actually not in reference to the city. It's not in reference to Rivka. Where is the first reference?
It's a person.
Nope, before him. Even before him, before the story of Dinah, it's actually Noah's children, Noah's sons. He has three sons, Shem, Ham, and Yafet. Shem, Ham, love that one, right? And Yafet, Jephet. Why do they have to ruin such good names? Shem, Ham, and Yafet, okay? And the story goes that what happens? What's the famous story with Noah?
Gets drunk.
That's the famous story? You know what, Monroe? Why don't you teach this one? Because I'd like to hear where this one's going.
After he got all things.
Oh, there was an ark. Oh, hello. Right, there was a flood. Sheesh.
He released a raven first.
Right, the ravens, that's correct. Okay, but let's jump ahead because Monroe's right. What happens after the story with the flood? He comes off the ark, he plants a vineyard, and sure enough, he gets drunk.
Right.
He does. And the Torah tells us that he's lying there unclothed in his tent, and in walks...
Daughters.
No daughters. No daughters. Walks in one son. No, no, no. Who? Which son? Wrong. Wrong. It's not Shem.
Not Japheth either.
You're down to Mr. Porkloin. Right? Ham is the one who goes in, sees his father undressed, and instead of doing something to protect his father's dignity, instead he comes out to his other brothers and is somewhat funny about it. I was like, oh, take a look at this. Right? The other two brothers, Shem and Yefes, are embarrassed for their father. So the Torah tells us that they walked in. And, yes, they walked in backwards. Again, not to look at their father's, right? Oh, you'd think? You didn't know that till about a minute ago, till it occurred to you. That little piece of information, how many times we've seen this, we go right over it. But here's what it says. It says black on white. It says Beferush. Explicitly. And Shem and Yefes took a garment, laid it upon both their shoulders. And they walked backwards and covered their father's nakedness. Their faces were turned away and they saw not their father's nakedness. Tremendous display of dignity for their father. But lo and behold, they're holding this blanket, this cloth, whatever it is. They walk in back. Who cares? It's on their shoulders. It's not, and if it was in front of their face or if it was, you know, around their hip, who cares? Who really cares? This seems like such a trivial piece of information that the Torah seems to tell us. But Gene, is there anything trivial in this Torah?
Yeah.
There is. There's trivial stuff in the Torah. Just willy-nilly. Nuh-uh. There is nothing in here that's for naught. Everything has a reason. Rabbi Bechaffer writes the following. He really says such a beautiful idea. The word Shem, right? The son. Shem means, what is Shem? Ma Shem Shelcha. What is your
name?
Shem means name, right? This son's name is name, right? Sounds like God. What's God's name? Hashem, the name, right? But Shem is his name. That means name. Yefet means, what's Yefet?
Beautiful.
Beautiful. Excellent. Beautiful. Beautiful.
Thank you.
Beautiful. Yefet is beauty. Okay? You have name and beauty are the two sons that are heroes of the story. Okay? We'll forget about Ham for now. Okay? Well, he's forget about Ham ever.
Yeah.
Okay? You have Shem and Yefet. Rabbi Bechaffer's main point is as follows. He says beauty is really an external thing. Sure, it could reflect something on the inside, but beauty, when you perceive it, is all external. In fact, even the English expression, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. It's how you see it. It's skin deep. It's not talking about the essence of the person necessarily, right? Plenty of wonderful, wonderful people whose essence are amazing are not gorgeous. And there were plenty of gorgeous, drop-dead guys and gals that are absolute zeros. They are garnished mid-garnished. They're less than zero, right? The beauty on is all external. The name, however, we've spoken about this many, many times. The name of something is describing its essence, right? That's why we're so particular about using our Hebrew name. Because it's our essence. It's who we are as a person. The name of something. I mentioned it before. The fact that we call God, we can't come up with any name for God because there's no way to describe his essence. So we just call him the name. Whatever that is, I can't describe it. Right? Because I can't get to his essence. It's beyond me. It's beyond human comprehension. Yes? So you have these two children. One is Shem, who's all about inner essence, and one who's Yefet, beauty, is all about externals. They're coming at it from two different perspectives. Yet they join together to save the dignity of their father. They can form another partnership. Shem and Yefet can work together. Yefet by itself, beauty, external beauty by itself is a zero. But when it's in conjunction with someone who has a true essence, a character, something of value, then beauty just enhances that person even more. They can work together. In fact, that's the blessing Noah gives. He said, "Blessed is Hashem, God of Shem," because he's the main guy. Right? "May God extend Yefet, but he will dwell in the tents of Shem." Yefet will have a place as long as he's connected and working together with Shem. Yefet by itself is a garnished, is a zero. It's just external. Which nation in history represented all about the external beauty, physicality?
Greece.
That's the Olympics. That's where everything about the body. It's all about Greek culture. This is the clash of Hanukkah, of an internal sense of value system versus external beauty. This is what the clash was about. It wasn't a physical threat to the Jewish people. It's not like the story of Purim. Hanukkah was a spiritual war, an ideological war. An external culture that said that's all that mattered versus an internal. That's why the Greeks came in. They didn't destroy the temple. They desecrated it. Don't tell me it has these intangible spiritual things. Either it's a physical beautiful building or not physically beautiful building. Yeah, no. Make up your mind. Oh, it represents... No, I don't want to hear from that. So the way it is, they defiled it. They didn't smash anything. They defiled it. They said, don't tell me this oil is any different than that oil. Why? Because this is no longer spiritually pure? Farfignugan. That's baloney. This was a clash that they had. So Shem and Yefet can work together. One's the in, one's the out. Internal, external. That's the battle of Jews, right? The Greeks wanted beauty to be everything. We refer to the temple, an area, interestingly enough, that in the Torah it's described, L'shaken Shemo Shem, where God dwells his name there. It's a funny expression. Why does it say dwell him there? What's dwells his name? Yeah, because name represents what?
The
essence, the inside. That's where God's essence dwells. That's all about the internals.
Well, that's also how you're going to be judged in the next world.
Correct.
What kind of name did you have?
That's correct. But understand, this isn't just, you know, the name. It means who you are. Yes. It's your essence. Very good. Now we go back to his point. Shem is the combination of Shem, Kivod Malchuto. Shem means name. That's inside, the inner values. Kivod Malchuto means the glory of his kingdom. Glory of a kingdom, that's all externals. How is the kingdom portrayed? What does the king show off his riches? How is it perceived in the eyes of the other nations? That's Kivod Malchuto. That's the glory of his kingdom. Shem and Kivod Malchuto seem to be at odds with each other. Unless you have them work side by side. Like Shem and Yefet can work together. How? Shem, the shoulders. It's an interesting thing. Two separate shoulder blades, right? But they work in conjunction with each other. There's a sense of working together. The idea of being able to work the inside and the outside, the Shem and the Kavod Malchuto together is all possible. The city of Shechem, therefore, is the place on earth where this battle of inside versus outside took place. Let's talk about Dinah. How did that story begin? It starts with one line. Do you remember?
When she went to visit.
She went, I'm looking for one word in particular.
The daughters of the land or something.
Or something.
She went
exploring. She went, yeah.
Exploring.
Yeah, what's the key word, though? What's the word for right now?
The sea.
I'll give you a hint. It's not in. Oh, and out. The opening line. Vatetse Dina. And Dina went out. Why did you just say she went? Vatelach Dina. She went. That's how I would have expressed it. What do you mean she went out? She went out. She went to a point of where it wasn't inner. She went exploring the outside. And who takes her? Who but the name of? Shechem. Shechem is the one who takes her. That's his name. Shechem ben Hamor. Right? Interestingly enough. Shechem, the son of, what's Hamor in Hebrew?
Donkey.
A donkey of all things. You have Shechem and you have Hamor. Have we not been talking about this all night? The pattern is ridiculous. Shechem ben Hamor? Yeah. Because he's not willing. The whole city is all about the externals. Oh, she's beautiful. Let's take her. Aye, she belongs to a different clan. Eh, whatever. What do you mean, whatever? When you don't go ahead and you don't focus in on making sure that the in is together with the out, and you're looking at just the out beauty for itself, you run into trouble. Yosef is sold by his brothers, specifically Yehuda. Yehuda and Yosef also represent this rift. Yosef is all inside, Yehuda's on the outside. Or should really say it the other way. Yehuda's truth is on the inside. On the outside, he looks terrible. If you read some of the stories with Yehuda, he looks like a goof. How could he be the guy who royalty comes from? He messes up with his daughter-in-law Tamar. He's the one who sells Joseph. He looks like the bad guy on the outside. But we know, knowing from reading the stories carefully, that maybe on the outside it looked bad, but all of the intentions, everything about Yehuda on the inside was right on the mark. Yosef was the opposite. Yosef, on the outside, looked like a great guy. He's got all of these things, but internally, he was struggling. There's a Yosef and Yehuda rift. The point is as follows, and we'll end with this. This rift of having the in and the out, where the word Shechem, Shem Kivod Malchuto, how the Arizal puts it, right? This struggle of in versus out will at the end of days all come finally together. Because the verse tells us in the prophet Zephaniah that in the end of time, all the nations will call out in the name of Hashem and serve Him, Shechem Echad, as one. One unified world. Unified. In total, unified shoulder, in unison. One unified shoulder. The flow of the influence from in to out and out to in will be in harmony. Shechem will no longer be associated as only the bad things that happen there. But Shechem can actually be the place. Like Yosef being buried there. That's ultimately to our benefit. That's where it's all unified. Finally, this concept of where standing shoulder to shoulder, that even that expression, where you can go ahead and say that we're unified together, right? Even in English, that's the term we use. We stand shoulder to shoulder. I don't stand hip to hip. Don't try this, right? But I stand shoulder to shoulder because that's what the shoulder represents. The ability to stand and to burden it with someone else, shoulder to shoulder. The city of Shechem, we'll end with this. The city of Shechem borders on Mount Gerizim. Har Gerizim. Har Eval and Har Gerizim are the two mountains right before the Jews entered into the land of Israel. Moshe gathers them and says, he's going to get six tribes on one, six tribes on the other, the Levites in the middle, and we're going to give blessings and curses, and everyone's going to respond, Amen, right? Har Gerizim is the mountain that's right near Shechem. If you read through Judaic literature, what you find is that this incident, right before they go in, where they're on the two separate mountains, is where they all agree to take responsibility for each other. Kol Yisrael arevim ze lo ze. All Jews are responsible one for the other. I cannot, in good conscience, go to sleep at night saying, I did my mitzvah today, that's all I have to worry about. I have to worry that my fellow brothers and sisters may not have done it. And what am I doing to help them? My day is not complete, even though I may have done everything on my bucket list for the day. Doesn't count. Because I know you didn't do it yet. Not you. Out there, you. You guys are all doing it. That comes about because of Har Gerizim. That mountain that's right near Shechem. Standing shoulder to shoulder. So let's end with this. Let's put this all together again. Shoulders. There's two words in the Torah for shoulders. There's the word katef. Kaf tav vet fe, sorry. Ktefav, shoulders. And Shechem. Both of them have this word shoulders. You see it in the context of Noach's children. You see it in regards to the Levites carrying on their shoulders. We didn't even get to the fact that the Meraglim, the spies, when they brought back the fruits from Israel, they had them on poles resting on their shoulders. We can tie that in as well if you think about it. I'll leave that for homework. Right? We talk about the fact that this message about being like the donkey, strong-boned, willing to bear the responsibility, to carry forth the Torah values. They're all connected in this regard. And ultimately, that's what the Beit HaMikdash, the temple was. Was the place where God's presence dwelled that reminded us what this is all about. All of that is associated with the shoulders. So learn from the shoulders the sense of responsibility as a Jew to carry the Torah. And remember, if you sincerely carry it, what will happen? It will carry you, number one. And number two, take out of this that the idea that shoulders are meant to stand with others, like you correctly pointed out, where you bear the burden with someone, our responsibility, one Jew for the other. Both of those aspects are alluded to in this concept of shoulders. Questions? Yes, ma'am. Yes, we're done.
I'm sitting here thinking visually of Samson and his use of his shoulders as he destroys the temple. Any correlation?
I'd have to look
with his hair.
Right. I'd have to look. I'd have to look
back in at this point.
Right. That is correct. I'd have to look back. I don't recall whether the verse identifies it with the shoulders or just. I think it says he grabbed them with his arms. I'd have to look. I don't want to go on record. Right? I don't want to go on record as to whether. It's I don't recall. I will, Billy Nader, I will look tonight to see. If it doesn't say shoulders, then I stand by that this is more related to hair and his hands being the source of the strength, his hair. But if it does say shoulders, then yeah, we have to find additional connection to that.
Okay.
Definitely.
We brought up the donkey. Something hit me when you were talking. And
careful.
Balaam and his donkey.
Good.
So the donkey of being this, one of the other non-kosher animals mentioned. And
right.
That you said in the beginning. Yet carries Balaam. And remember, Balaam goes to do his...
curses, right?
And they're all blessings.
Right. That's correct.
So in other words, so again, as you say, shoulder, the carrying, Balaam was carried by this donkey.
That's correct. And I find it fascinating, and that's the creature, right, that has the privilege of talking what God told it to do.
Correct. Talk to him, please.
Okay. How often does that happen, right? I mean, in it's pretty fascinating. Pretty cool. All right. Have a great rest of the week. We'll see you hopefully next week.